This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents The Raven Boys, Book 1 of The Raven Cycle by Maggie Stiefvater, read by Will Patton. Deep into that darkness peering, long I stood there, wondering, fearing, doubting. Dreaming dreams no mortal ever dared to dream before. Edgar Allan Poe. A dreamer is one who can only find his way by moonlight, and his punishment is that he sees the dawn before the rest of the world. Oscar Wilde. Prologue. Blue Sargent had forgotten how many times she'd been told that she would kill her true love. Her family traded in predictions. These predictions tended, however, to run toward the nonspecific. Things like, something terrible will happen to you today. It might involve the number 6. Or, money is coming. Open your hand for it. Or, you have a big decision and it will not make itself. The people who came to the little bright blue house at 300 Fox Way didn't mind the imprecise nature of their fortunes. It became a game, a challenge to realize the exact moment that the predictions came true. When a van carrying 6 people wheeled into a client's car 2 hours after his psychic reading, he could nod with a sense of accomplishment and release. When a neighbor offered to buy another client's old lawnmower if she was looking for a bit of extra cash, she could recall the promise of money coming and sell it with the sense that the transaction had been foretold. Or when a third client heard his wife say, "This is a decision that has to be made," he could remember the same words being said by Maura Sargent over a spread of tarot cards and then leap decisively to action. But the imprecise nature of the fortune stole some of their power. The predictions could be dismissed as coincidences, hunches. They were a chuckle in the Walmart parking lot when you ran into an old friend as promised. A shiver when the number 17 appeared on an electric bill. A realization that even if you had discovered the future, it really didn't change how you lived in the present. They were truth, but they weren't all of the truth. "I should tell you," Maura always advised her new clients, "that this reading will be accurate, but not specific." It was easier that way. But this was not what Blue was told. Again and again, she had her fingers spread wide, her palm examined, her cards plucked from velvet-edged decks and spread across the fuzz of a family friend's living room carpet. Thumbs were pressed to the mystical, invisible third eye that was said to lie between everyone's eyebrows. Runes were cast, and dreams interpreted, tea leaves scrutinized, and seances conducted. All the women came to the same conclusion, blunt and inexplicably specific. What they all agreed on, in many different clairvoyant languages, was this. If Blue was to kiss her true love, he would die. For a long time, this bothered Blue. The warning was specific, certainly, but in the way of a fairy tale. It didn't say how her true love would die. It didn't say how long after the kiss he would survive. Did it have to be a kiss on the lips? Would a chaste peck on the back of his palm prove as deadly? Until she was 11, Blue was convinced she would silently contract an infectious disease. One press of her lips to her hypothetical soulmate and he too would die in a consumptive battle untreatable by modern medicine. When she was 13, Blue decided that jealousy would kill him instead, an old boyfriend emerging at the moment of that first kiss bearing a handgun and a heart full of hurt. When she turned 15, Blue concluded that her mother's tarot cards were just a pack of playing cards and that the dreams of her mother and the other clairvoyant women were fueled by mixed drinks rather than otherworldly insight, and so the prediction didn't matter. She knew better, though. The predictions that came out of 300 Fox Way were unspecific, but undeniably true. Her mother had dreamt Blue's broken wrist on the first day of school. Her Aunt Jimmy predicted Maura's tax return to within $10. Her older cousin Orla always began to hum her favorite song a few minutes before it came on the radio. No one in the house ever really doubted that Blue was destined to kill her true love with a kiss. It was a threat, however, that had been around for so long that it had lost its force. Picturing 6-year-old Blue in love was such a far-off thing as to be imaginary. And by 16, Blue had decided she would never fall in love, so it didn't matter. But that belief changed when her mother's half-sister Neve came to their little town of Henrietta. Neve had gotten famous for doing loudly what Blue's mother did quietly. Mora's readings were done in her front room, mostly for residents of Henrietta and the valley around it. Neve, on the other hand, did her readings on television at 5 o'clock in the morning. She had a website featuring old, soft focus photographs of her staring unerringly at the viewer. 4 books on the supernatural bore her name on the cover. Blue had never met Neve, so she knew more about her half-aunt from a cursory web search than from personal experience. Blue wasn't sure why Neve was coming to visit, but she knew her imminent arrival spurred a legion of whispered conversations between Mora and her 2 best friends, Persephone and Calla, the sort of conversations that trailed off into sipping coffee and tapping pins on the table when Blue entered the room. But Blue wasn't particularly concerned about Neve's arrival. What was one more woman in a house filled to the brim with them? Neve finally appeared on a spring evening when the already long shadows of the mountains to the west seemed even longer than usual. When Blue opened the door for her, she thought for a moment that Neve was an unfamiliar old woman, but then her eyes grew used to the stretched crimson light coming through the trees, and she saw that Neve was barely older than her mother, which was not very old at all. Outside in the distance, hounds were crying. Blue was familiar enough with their voices. Each fall, the Aglinby Hunt Club rode out with horses and foxhounds nearly every weekend. Blue knew what their frantic howls meant at that moment. They were on the chase. "You're Mora's daughter," Neve said, and before Blue could answer, she added, "This is the year you'll fall in love." 1. It was freezing in the churchyard even before the dead arrived. Every year, Blue and her mother, Mora, had come to the same place, and every year it was chilly. But this year, without Mora here with her, it felt colder. It was April 24th, St. Mark's Eve. For most people, St. Mark's Day came and went without note. It wasn't a school holiday. No presents were exchanged. There were no costumes or festivals. There were no St. Mark's Day sales, no St. Mark's Day cards in the store racks, no special television programs that aired only once a year. No one marked April 25th on their calendar. In fact, most of the living were unaware that St. Mark even had a day named in his honor. But the dead remembered. As Blue sat shivering on the stone wall, she reasoned that at least, at the very least, it wasn't raining this year. Every St. Mark's Eve, this was where Mara and Blue drove, an isolated church so old that its name had been forgotten. The ruin was cupped in the densely wooded hills outside of Henrietta, still several miles from the mountains proper. Only the exterior walls remained. The roof and floors had long ago collapsed inside. What hadn't rotted away was hidden under hungry vines and rancid-smelling saplings. The church was surrounded by a stone wall, broken only by a lich gate just large enough for a coffin and its bearers. A stubborn path that seemed impervious to weeds led through to the old church door. "Ah," hissed Neve, plump but strangely elegant, as she sat beside Blue on the wall. Blue was struck again, as she had been struck the first time she'd met Neve, by her oddly lovely hands. Chubby wrists led to soft, childlike palms and slender fingers with oval nails. "Ah," Neve murmured again, "tonight is a night." She said it like this, "tonight is a night." And when she did, Blue felt her skin creep a little. Blue had sat watch with her mother for the past 10 St. Mark's Eves, but tonight felt different. Tonight was a night. This year, for the first time and for reasons Blue didn't understand, Mora sent Neve to do the church watch in her place. Her mother had asked Blue if she would go along as usual, but it wasn't really a question. Blue had always gone. She would go this time. It was not as if she had made plans for St. Mark's Eve, but she had to be asked. Maura had decided sometime before Blue's birth that it was barbaric to order children about, and so Blue had grown up surrounded by imperative question marks. Blue opened and closed her chilly fists. The top edges of her fingerless gloves were fraying. She'd done a bad job knitting them last year, but they had a certain trashy chic to them. If she hadn't been so vain, Blue could have worn the boring but functional gloves she'd been given for Christmas. But she was vain, so instead, she had her fraying fingerless gloves, infinitely cooler, though also colder, and no one to see them but Neve and the dead. April days in Henrietta were quite often fair, tender things, coaxing sleeping trees to bud and love-mad ladybugs to beat against window panes. But not tonight. It felt like winter. Blue glanced at her watch. A few minutes until 11. The old legends recommended the church watch be kept at midnight, but the dead kept poor time, especially when there wasn't a moon. Unlike Blue, who didn't tend toward patience, Neve was a regal statue on the old church wall, hands folded, ankles crossed beneath a long wool skirt. Blue, huddled, shorter and thinner, was a restless, sightless gargoyle. It wasn't a night for her ordinary eyes. It was a night for seers and psychics, witches and mediums. In other words, the rest of her family. Out of the silence, Neve asked, "Do you hear anything?" Her eyes glittered in the black. "No," Blue answered, "because she didn't." Then she wondered if Neve had asked because Neve did. Neve was looking at her with the same gaze that she wore in all of her photos on the website. The deliberately unnerving, otherworldly stare that lasted several more seconds than was comfortable. A few days after Neve had arrived, Blue had been distressed enough to mention it to Maura. They had both been crammed into the single bathroom, Blue getting ready for school, Maura for work. Blue trying to clip all of the various bits of her dark hair back into a vestigial ponytail had asked, "Does she have to stare like that?" In the shower, her mother drew patterns in the steamed glass door. She had paused to laugh, a flash of her skin visible through the long intersecting line she had drawn. "Oh, that's just Neve's trademark." Blue thought there were probably better things to be known for. In the churchyard, Neve said enigmatically, "There is a lot to hear." The thing was, there wasn't. In the summer, the foothills were alive with insects buzzing, mockingbirds whistling back and forth, ravens yelling at cars. But it was too cool tonight for anything to be awake yet. "I don't hear things like that," Blue said, a little surprised Neve wasn't already aware. In Blue's intensely clairvoyant family, she was a fluke, an outsider to the vibrant conversation her mother and aunts and cousins held with a world hidden to most people. The only thing that was special about her was something that she herself couldn't experience. "I hear as much of the conversation as the telephone. I just make things louder for everyone else." Neve still hadn't looked away. "So that's why Maura was so eager for you to come along. Does she have you at all her readings as well?" Blue shuddered at the thought. A fair number of the clients who entered 300 Fox Way were miserable women hoping Maura would see love and money in their future. The idea of being trapped in the house with that all day was excruciating. Blue knew it had to be very tempting for her mother to have Blue present, making her psychic powers stronger. When she was younger, she'd never appreciated how little Maura called on her to join in a reading. But now that Blue understood how well she honed other people's talents, she was impressed at Maura's restraint. "Not unless it's a very important one," she replied. Neve's gaze had edged over the subtle line between discomforting and creepy. She said, "It's something to be proud of, you know. To make someone else's psychic gift stronger is a rare and valuable thing." "Oh, pshaw," Blue said, but not cruelly. She meant to be funny. She'd had 16 years to get used to the idea that she wasn't privy to the supernatural. She didn't want Neve to think she was experiencing an identity crisis over it. She tugged a string on her glove. "And you have plenty of time to grow into your own intuitive talents, Neve added. Her gaze seemed hungry. Blue didn't reply. She wasn't interested in telling other people's futures. She was interested in going out and finding her own. Neve finally dropped her eyes. Tracing an idle finger through the dirt on the stones between them, she said, I passed by a school on the way into town. Aglenby Academy. Is that where you go? Blue's eyes widened with humor, but of course Neve, an outsider, couldn't know. Still, surely she could have guessed from the massive stone great hall and the parking lot full of cars that spoke German that it wasn't the sort of school that they could afford.
It's an all-boys school. For politician sons and oil baron sons and for...
Blue struggled to think of who else might be rich enough to send their kids to Aglenby.
The sons of mistresses living off hush money.
Neve raised an eyebrow without looking up.
No, really, they're awful,
Blue said. April was a bad time for the Aglenby boys. As it warmed up, the convertibles appeared, bearing boys in shorts so tacky that only the rich would dare to wear them. During the school week, they all wore the Aglenby uniform, khaki pants and a V-neck sweater with a raven emblem. It was an easy way to identify the advancing army. Raven boys. Blue continued. They think they're better than us and that we're all falling all over ourselves for them and they drink themselves senseless every weekend and spray paint the Henrietta exit sign. Aglenby Academy was the number one reason Blue had developed her two rules. One, stay away from boys because they were trouble. And two, stay away from Aglenby boys because they were bastards.
You seem like a very sensible teen, Neve said, which annoyed Blue because she already knew she was a very sensible teen.
When you had as little money as the sergeants did, sensibility in all matters was ingrained young. In the ambient light from the nearly full moon, Blue caught sight of what Neve had drawn in the dirt. She asked, What is that?
Mom drew that.
Did she? Neve asked. They studied the pattern. It was three curving, intersecting lines making a long sort of triangle.
Did she say what it was?
She was drawing it on the shower door. I didn't ask.
I dreamt it, Neve said, in a flat voice that sent an unpleasant shudder along the back of Blue's neck. I wanted to see what it looked like drawn out.
She rubbed her palm through the pattern. Then abruptly held up a beautiful hand. She said,
I think they're coming.
This was why Blue and Neve were here. Every year, Mora sat on the wall, knees pulled up to her chin, staring at nothing, and recited names to Blue. To Blue, the churchyard remained empty, but to Mora, it was full of the dead. Not the currently dead, but the spirits of those who would die in the next 12 months. For Blue, it had always been like hearing one half of a conversation. Sometimes her mother would recognize the spirits, but often she would have to lean forward to ask them their names. Mora had once explained that if Blue wasn't there, she couldn't convince them to answer her. The dead couldn't see Mora without Blue's presence. Blue never grew tired of feeling particularly needed, but sometimes she wished needed felt less like a synonym for useful. The church watch was critical for one of Mara's most unusual services. So long as clients lived in the area, she guaranteed to let them know if they or a local loved one was bound to die in the next 12 months. Who wouldn't pay for that? Well, the true answer was most of the world, as most people didn't believe in psychics.
Can you see anything?
Blue asked. She gave her numb hands a bracing rub before snatching up a notebook and pen from the wall. Neve was very still.
Something just touched my hair.
Again, a shiver thrilled up Blue's arms.
One of them?
In a husky voice, Neve said, The future dead have to follow the corpse road through the gate. This is probably another spirit called by your energy. I didn't realize what an effect you would have. Mora had never mentioned other dead people being attracted by Blue. Perhaps she hadn't wanted to scare her. Or maybe Mora just hadn't seen them. Maybe she was as blind to these other spirits as Blue was. Blue became uncomfortably aware of the slightest breeze touching her face, lifting Neve's curly hair. Invisible, orderly spirits of not yet truly dead people were one thing. Ghosts that weren't compelled to stay on the path were another.
Are they?
Blue started.
Who are you?
Robert Newman, Neve interrupted.
What's your name?
Ruth Vert.
What's your name?
Francis Powell.
Scratching quickly to catch up, Blue printed the names phonetically as Neve solicited them. Every so often she lifted her eyes to the path, trying to glimpse something. But as always, there was only the overgrown crabgrass, the barely visible oak trees, the black mouth of the church accepting invisible spirits. Nothing to hear, nothing to see, no evidence of the dead except for their names written in the notebook in her hand. Maybe Neve was right. Maybe Blue was having a bit of an identity crisis. Some days it did seem a little unfair that all of the wonder and power that surrounded her family was passed to Blue in the form of paperwork. At least I can still be a part of it, Blue thought grimly. All that she felt about is included as a seeing-eye dog. She held the notebook up to her face, close, 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 so she could read it in the darkness. It was like a roster of names popular 70 and 80 years before. Dorothy, Ralph, Clarence, Esther, Herbert, Melvin. A lot of the same last names, too. The valley was dominated by several old families that were large, if not powerful. Somewhere outside of Blue's thoughts, Neve's tone became more emphatic.
"What's your name?" she asked.
"Excuse me, what is your name?" Her consternated expression looked wrong on her face. Out of habit, Blue followed Neve's gaze to the center of the courtyard, and she saw someone. Blue's heart hammered like a fist to her breastbone. On the other side of the heartbeat, he was still there. Where there should have been nothing, there was a person.
"I see him," Blue said. "Neve, I see him."
Blue had always imagined the procession of spirits to be an orderly thing, but this spirit wandered, hesitant. It was a young man in slacks and a sweater, hair rumpled. He was not quite transparent, but he wasn't quite there either. His figure was as murky as dirty water, his face indistinct. There was no identifying feature to him apart from his youth. He was so young. That was the hardest part to get used to. As Blue watched, he paused and put his fingers to the side of his nose and his temple. It was such a strangely living gesture that Blue felt a little sick. Then he stumbled forward as if jostled from behind.
"Get his name," Neve hissed. "He won't answer me and I need to get the others."
"Me?" Blue replied, but she slid off the wall. Her heart was still ramming inside her rib cage. She asked, feeling a little foolish, "What's your name?" He didn't seem to hear her. Without a twitch of acknowledgement, he began to move again, slow and bewildered, toward the church door. "Is this how we make our way to death?" Blue wondered. "A stumbling fade-out instead of a self-aware finale?" As Neve began again to call out questions to the others, Blue made her way toward the wanderer. "Who are you?" she called from a safe distance as he dropped his forehead into his hands. His form had no outline at all, she saw now, and his face was truly featureless. There was nothing about him really that made him human-shaped, but still she saw a boy. There was something telling her mind what he was, even if it wasn't telling her eyes. There was no thrill in seeing him as she had thought there would be. All she could think was, "He will be dead within a year. How did Maura bear it?" Blue stole closer. She was close enough to touch him as he began to walk again, but still he made no sign of seeing her. This near to him, her hands were freezing. Her heart was freezing. Invisible spirits with no warmth of their own sucked at her energy, pulling goosebumps up her arms. The young man stood on the threshold of the church, and Blue knew, just knew, that if he stepped into the church, she would lose the chance to get his name. "Please," Blue said, softer than before. She reached out a hand and touched the very edge of his not-there sweater. Cold flooded through her like dread. She tried to steady herself with what she'd always been told.
Spirits drew all their energy from their surroundings. All she was feeling was him using her to stay visible, but it still felt a lot like dread. She asked, "Will you tell me your name?" He faced her, and she realized with shock that he wore an Aglenby sweater. "Gansey," he said. Though his voice was quiet, it wasn't a whisper. It was a real voice spoken from someplace almost too far away to hear. Blue couldn't stop staring at his mussed hair, the suggestion of staring eyes, the raven on his sweater. His shoulders were soaked, she saw, and the rest of his clothing rain-spattered from a storm that hadn't happened yet. This close, she could smell something minty that she wasn't sure was unique to him or unique to spirits. He was so real. When it finally happened, when she finally saw him, it didn't feel like magic at all. It felt like looking into the grave and seeing it look back at her. "Is that all?" she whispered. Gansey closed his eyes. "That's all there is." He fell to his knees, a soundless gesture for a boy with no real body. One hand splayed in the dirt, fingers pressed to the ground. Blue saw the blackness of the church more clearly than the curved shape of his shoulder. "Neve," Blue said. "Neve, he's dying." Neve had come to stand just behind her. She replied, "Not yet." Gansey was nearly gone now, fading into the church, or the church fading into him. Blue's voice was breathier than she would have liked. Why can I see him?" Neve glanced over her shoulder, either because there were more spirits coming or because there weren't. Blue couldn't tell. By the time she looked back, Gansey had vanished entirely. Already Blue felt warmth returning to her skin, but something behind her lungs felt icy. A dangerous sucking sadness seemed to be opening up inside her. Grief or regret. "There are only two reasons a non-seer would see a spirit on St. Mark's Eve, Blue. Either you're his true love," Neve said, "or you killed him."
2. "It's me," said Gansey. He turned around so that he was facing his car. The Camaro's bright orange hood was up, more as a symbol of defeat than for any practical use. Adam, friend of cars everywhere, might have been able to determine what was wrong with it this time, but Gansey certainly couldn't. He'd managed to roll to a stop about 4 feet off the interstate, and now the car's fat tires sat off-kilter on top of lumpy tufts of valley grass. A semi-truck roared by without pause. The Camaro rocked in its wake. On the other end of the phone, his roommate Ronan Lynch replied, "You missed world hist. I thought you were dead in a ditch." Gansey flipped his wrist around to examine his watch. He had missed a lot more than world history. It was 11 o'clock, and already the chilliness of last night seemed improbable. A gnat was stuck in the perspiration on his skin next to the watch band. He flicked it off. Gansey had camped once when he was younger. It had involved tents, sleeping bags, an idling Range Rover parked nearby for when he and his father lost interest. As an experience, it had not been anything like last night. He asked, "Did you get notes for me?" "No," Ronan replied. "I thought you were dead in a ditch." Gansey blew grit off his lips and readjusted the phone against his cheek. He would have gotten notes for Ronan. "The pig stopped. Come get me." A sedan slowed as it passed, the occupant staring out the window. Gansey was not an unpleasant-looking boy, and the Camaro was not too hard on the eyes either, but this attention had less to do with comeliness and more to do with the novelty of an Aglenby boy broken down by the side of the road in an impudently orange car. Gansey was well aware that there was nothing little Henrietta Virginia preferred over seeing humiliating things happen to Aglenby boys, unless it was seeing humiliating things happen to their families. Ronan said, "Come on, man." "It's not like you're going to class. You know what? It'll be lunch break anyway." Then he added perfunctory, "Please." Ronan was silent for a long moment. He was good at silence. He knew it made people uncomfortable. But Gansey was immune from long exposure. He leaned into the car to see if he had any food in the glove box while he waited for Ronan to speak. Next to an EpiPen, there was a stick of beef jerky, but the jerky had expired 2 years ago. Possibly it had been there when he'd bought the car. "Where are you?" Ronan asked finally. next to the Henrietta sign on 64. Bring me a burger and a few gallons of gas. The car had not run out of gas, but it couldn't hurt. Ronan's voice was acidic.
Gansey.
Bring Adam, too. Ronan hung up. Gansey stripped off his sweater and threw it in the back of the Camaro. The tiny back of the car was a cluttered marriage of everyday things. A chemistry textbook, a Frappuccino-stained notebook, a half-zipped CD binder with naked discs slithering out across the seat, and the supplies he'd acquired during his 18 months in Henrietta. Rumpled maps, computer printouts, ever-present journal, flashlight, willow stick. When Gansey plucked a digital recorder out of the mess, a pizza receipt, one large deep dish, half sausage, half avocado, fluttered to the seat, joining a half dozen receipts identical except for the date. All night, he'd sat outside the monstrously modern Church of the Holy Redeemer, recorder running, ear straining, waiting for something. The atmosphere had been less than magical. Possibly not the best place to try to make contact with the future dead, but Gansey had maintained high hopes for the power of St. Mark's Eve. It wasn't that he'd expected to see the dead. All of the sources said that church watchers had to possess the second sight, and Gansey barely possessed first sight before he put his contacts in. He just hoped for something, and that was what he had gotten. He just wasn't quite sure what that something was yet. The digital recorder in hand, Gansey settled himself against the rear tire to wait, letting the car shield him from the buffeting of passing vehicles. On the other side of the guardrail, a greening field stretched out and down to the trees. Beyond it all rose the mysterious blue crest of the mountains. On the dusty toe of his shoe, Gansey drew the arcing shape of the promised supernatural energy line that had led him here. As the mountain breeze rushed over his ears, it sounded like a hushed shout, not a whisper, but a loud cry from almost too far away to hear. The thing was, Henrietta looked like a place where magic could happen. The valley seemed to whisper secrets. It was easier to believe that they wouldn't give themselves up to Gansey rather than that they didn't exist at all. Please just tell me where you are. His heart hurt with the wanting of it, the hurt no less painful for being difficult to explain. Ronan Lynch's shark-nosed BMW pulled in behind the Camaro, its normally glossy charcoal paint dusted green with pollen. Gansey felt the bass of the stereo in his feet a moment before he made out the tune. When he stood up, Ronan was just opening his door. In the passenger seat was Adam Parrish, the third member of the foursome that made up Gansey's closest friends. The knot of Adam's tie was neat above the collar of his sweater. One slender hand pressed Ronan's thin cell phone tightly to his ear. Through the open car door, Adam and Gansey exchanged the briefest of looks. Adam's knitted eyebrows asked, "Did you find anything?" And Gansey's widened eyes replied, "You tell me." Adam, frowning now, spun the volume knob down on the stereo and said something into the phone. Ronan slammed the car door. He slammed everything before heading to the trunk. He said, "My dick brother wants us to meet him at Nino's tonight, with Ashley." "Is that who's on the phone?" Gansey asked. "What's Ashley?" Ronan hefted a gas can from the trunk, making little effort to keep the greasy container from contacting his clothing. Like Gansey, he wore the Aglin B uniform, but as always, he managed to make it look as disreputable as possible. His tie was knotted with a method best described as contempt, and his shirt tails were ragged beneath the bottom of his sweater. His smile was thin and sharp. If his BMW was shark-like, it had learned how from him. "Declan's latest. We're meant to look pretty for her." Gansey resented having to play nicely with Ronan's older brother, a senior at Aglinby, but he understood why they had to. Freedom in the Lynch family was a complicated thing, and at the moment, Declan held the keys to it. Ronan traded the fuel can for the digital recorder. "He wants to do it tonight because he knows I have class." The fuel tank lid for the Camaro was located behind the spring-loaded license plate, and Ronan watched silently as Gansey simultaneously wrestled with the lid, the gas can, and the license plate. "You could have done this," Gansey told him, "since you don't care about crapping up your shirt."
Unsympathetic, Ronan scratched at an old brown scab beneath the 5 knotted leather bands he wore around his wrist. Last week, he and Adam had taken turns dragging each other on a moving dolly behind the BMW, and they both still had the marks to show it. "Ask me if I found something," Gansey said. Sighing, Ronan twitched the recorder toward Gansey. "Did you find anything?" Ronan didn't sound very interested, but that was part of the Ronan Lynch brand. It was impossible to tell how deep his disinterest truly was. Fuel was leaching slowly into Gansey's expensive chinos, the second pair he'd ruined in a month. It wasn't that he meant to be careless, as Adam told him again and again. Things cost money, Gansey. It was just that he never seemed to realize the consequences of his actions until too late. "Something. I recorded about 4 hours of audio, and there's something, but I don't know what it means." He gestured to the recorder. "Give it a whirl." Turning to stare out over the interstate, Ronan pressed play. For a moment, there was merely silence, broken only by icy-sounding shrills of crickets. Then Gansey's voice. "Gansey," it said. There was a long pause. Gansey rubbed a finger slowly along the pocked chrome of the Camaro's bumper. It was still strange to hear himself on the recording with no memory of saying the words. Then, as if from very far away, a female voice, the words hard to make out. "Is that all?" Ronan's eyes darted to Gansey, wary. Gansey lifted his finger. "Wait." Murmured voices, quieter than before, hissed from the recorder. Nothing clear about them except the cadence, questions, and answers. And then his disembodied voice spoke out of the recorder again. "That's all there is." Ronan cast a glance back over to Gansey beside the car, doing what Gansey thought of as his smoker breath. Long inhale through flared nostrils, slow exhale through parted lips. Ronan did not smoke. He preferred his habits with hangovers. He stopped the recorder and said, "You're dripping gas on your pants, geezer. Aren't you going to ask me what was happening when I recorded that?" Ronan didn't ask. He just kept looking at Gansey, which was the same thing. "Nothing was happening. That's what. I was staring at a parking lot full of bugs that shouldn't be alive when it's this cold overnight, and there was nothing." Gansey hadn't really been sure if he'd pick up anything in the parking lot, even if he was in the right place. According to the lay hunters he'd spoken to, the ley line sometimes transmitted voices across its length, throwing sounds hundreds of miles and dozens of years from when they'd first been heard. A sort of audio haunting, an unpredictable radio transmission where nearly anything on the ley line could be a receiver, a recorder, a stereo, a pair of well-tuned human ears. Lacking any psychic ability, Gansey had brought the recorder, as the noises were often only audible when played back. The strange thing in all this was not the other voices on the player. The strange thing was Gansey's voice. Gansey was quite certain he was not a spirit. "I didn't say anything, Ronan, all night long. I didn't say anything. So what's my voice doing on the recorder?" "How did you know it was there?" "I was listening to what I'd recorded while I was driving back. Nothing, nothing, nothing. And then my voice. Then the pig stopped."
"Coincidence?" Ronan asked. "I think not." It was meant to be sarcastic. Gansey had said, "I don't believe in coincidences," so often that he no longer needed to. Gansey asked, "Well, what do you think?" "Holy grail, finally," Ronan replied, too sarcastic to be any use at all. But the fact was this. Gansey had spent the last 4 years working with the thinnest scraps of evidence possible, and the barely heard voice was all the encouragement he needed. His 18 months in Henrietta had used some of the sketchiest scraps of all as he searched for a ley line, a perfectly straight supernatural energy path that connected spiritual places, and the elusive tomb he hoped lay along its path. This was just an occupational hazard of looking for an invisible energy line. It was, well, invisible. And possibly hypothetical, but Gansey refused to consider that notion. In 17 years of life, he'd already found dozens of things people hadn't known could be found,
and he fully intended to add the ley line, the tomb, and the tomb's royal occupant to that list of items. A museum curator in New Mexico had once told Gansey, "Son, you have an uncanny knack for discovering oddities." An astonished Roman historian commented, "You look under rocks no one else thinks to pick up, Slick." And a very old British professor had said, "The world turns out its pockets for you, boy." The key, Gansey found, was that you had to believe that they existed. You had to realize they were part of something bigger. Some secrets only gave themselves up to those who'd proven themselves worthy. The way Gansey saw it was this. If you had a special knack for finding things, it meant you owed the world to look. "Hey, is that Welk?" Ronan asked. A car had slowed considerably as it passed them, affording them a glimpse of its overly curious driver. Gansey had to agree that the driver did look a lot like their resentful Latin teacher, an Aglinby alumnus by the unfortunate name of Barrington Welk. Gansey, owing to his official title of Richard Dick Campbell Gansey III, was fairly immune to posh names, but even he had to admit there wasn't much forgivable about Barrington Welk. "Hey, don't stop and help or anything," Ronan snapped after the car. "Hey, Runt, what went down with Declan?" This last part was directed at Adam as he climbed out of the BMW with Ronan's phone still in hand. He offered it to Ronan, who shook his head disdainfully. Ronan despised all phones, including his own. Adam said, "He's coming by at 5 tonight." Unlike Ronan, Adam's Aglinby sweater was second-hand, but he'd taken great care to be certain it was impeccable. He was slim and tall, with dusty hair unevenly cropped above a fine-boned, tanned face. He was a sepia photograph. "Joy," Gansey replied. "You'll be there, right?" "Am I invited?" Adam could be peculiarly polite. When he was uncertain about something, his southern accent always made an appearance, and it was in evidence now. Adam never needed an invitation. He and Ronan must have fought. Unsurprising. If it had a social security number, Ronan had fought with it. "Don't be stupid," Gansey replied, and graciously accepted the grease-splotched fast food bag that Adam offered. "Thanks." "Ronan got it," Adam said. In matters of money, he was quick to assign credit or blame. Gansey looked to Ronan, who lounged against the Camaro, absently biting one of the leather straps on his wrist. Gansey said, "Tell me there's no sauce on this burger." Dropping the strap from his teeth, Ronan scoffed, "Please." "No pickle either," Adam said, crouching behind the car. He'd not only brought two small containers of fuel additive, but also a rag to place between the gas can and his khakis. He made the entire process look commonplace. Adam tried so hard to hide his roots, but they came out in the smallest of gestures. Now, Gansey grinned, the warmth of discovery starting to course through him. "So, pop quiz, Mr. Parrish. 3 things that appear in the vicinity of ley lines." "Black dogs," Adam said indulgently. "Demonic presences." "Camaros," Ronan inserted. Gansey continued as if he hadn't spoken. "And ghosts." "Ronan, cue up the evidence, if you would." The 3 of them stood there in the late morning sun as Adam screwed the fuel tank lid back on and Ronan rewound the player. Yards and yards away over the mountains, a red-tailed hawk screamed thinly. Ronan pressed play again, and they listened to Gansey say his name into thin air. Adam frowned, distantly, listening, the warm day reddening his cheeks. It could have been any one of the mornings in the last year and a half. Ronan and Adam would make up by the end of the day. His teachers would forgive him for missing class. Then he and Adam and Ronan and Noah would go out for pizza, 4 against Declan. Adam said, "Try the car, Gansey." Leaving the door hanging open, Gansey crashed onto the driver's seat. In the background, Ronan played the recording again. For some reason, from this distance, the sound of the voices made the hair on his arm stand slowly. Something inside him said that this unconscious speech meant the start of something different, although he didn't know what yet. "Come on, pig," snarled Ronan. Someone laid on their horn as they blew by on the highway. Gansey turned the key. The engine turned over once, paused for the briefest of moments, and then roared to deafening life. The Camaro lived to fight another day. The radio was even working, playing the Stevie Nicks song that always sounded to Gansey like it was about a one-winged dove. He tried one of the French fries they'd brought him. They were cold. Adam leaned into the car. "We'll follow you back to the school. It'll get you back, but it's not done yet," he said. "There's still something wrong with it."
"Great," Gansey replied loudly to be heard over the engine.
In the background, the BMW pumped out a nearly inaudible bass line as Ronan dissolved what was left of his heart in electronic loops.
"So, suggestions?"
Reaching into his pocket, Adam retrieved a piece of paper and offered it to him. "What's this?" Gansey studied Adam's erratic handwriting. His letters always looked like they were running from something.
"A number for a psychic?"
"If you didn't find anything last night, this was going to be next. Now you have something to ask them about."
Gansey considered. Psychics tended to tell him he had money coming his way and that he was destined for great things. The first one he knew was always true, and the second one he was afraid might be. But maybe with this new clue, with a new psychic, they'd have something else to say.
"Okay," he agreed. "So what am I asking them?"
Adam handed him the digital recorder. He knocked the top of the Camaro once, twice, pensive.
"That seems obvious," he answered. "We find out who you were talking to."
3. Mornings at 300 Fox Way were fearful, jumbled things. Elbows insides and lines for the bathroom and people snapping over tea bags placed into cups that already had tea bags in them. There was school for Blue and work for some of the more productive or less intuitive ants. Toast got burned, cereal went soggy, the refrigerator door hung open and expectant for minutes at a time. Keys jingled as carpools were hastily decided. Partway through breakfast, the phone would begin to ring and Maura would say, "That's the universe calling for you on line 2, Orla," or something like that. And Jimmy or Orla or one of the other aunts or half-aunts or friends would fight over who had to pick it up on the upstairs phone. 2 years ago, Blue's cousin Orla had decided that a call-in psychic line would be a lucrative addition, and after some brief skirmishes with Maura about public image, Orla won. Winning involved Orla waiting until Maura was at a conference over a weekend to secretively set up the line, and it was not so much a sore spot as the memory of a sore spot. Calls started coming in around 7 a.m., and some days a dollar a minute felt more worth it than others. Mornings were a sport, one that Blue liked to think she was getting better at. But the day after the church watch, Blue didn't have to worry about battling for the bathroom or trying to make a bag lunch while Orla dropped toast butter side down. When she woke up, her normally morning bright room had the breath-held dimness of afternoon. In the next room over, Orla was talking to either her boyfriend or to one of the psychic hotline callers. With Orla, it was difficult to tell the difference between the two sorts of calls. Both of them left Blue thinking she ought to shower afterward. Blue took over the bathroom uncontested, where she gave most of her attention to her hair. Her dark hair was cut in a bob, long enough to plausibly pull back, but short enough that it required an assembly of clips to do so successfully. The end result was a spiky, uneven ponytail populated by escaped chunks and mismatched clips. It looked eccentric and unkempt. Blue had worked hard to get it that way. "Mom," she said as she jumped down the crooked stairs. Maura was at the kitchen counter making a mess of some kind of loose tea. It smelled appalling. Her mother didn't turn around. On the counter on either side of her were green, oceanic drifts of loose herbs. "You don't have to run everywhere."
"You do," Blue retorted. "Why didn't you wake me up for school?"
"I did," Maura said, "twice." Then to herself, "Damn it." From the table, Neve's mild voice said,
"Do you need my help with that, Maura?"
She sat at the table with a cup of tea, looking plump and angelic as always, no sign of having lost any sleep the night before. Neve stared at Blue, who tried to avoid eye contact.
"I'm perfectly capable of making a damn meditation tea, thank you," Maura said. To Blue, she added, "I told the school you had the flu. I emphasized that you were vomiting. Remember to look peaked tomorrow." Blue pressed the heels of her hands to her eyes. She'd never missed class the day after the church watch. Been sleepy, perhaps, but never wasted like last night. Was it because I saw him? She asked Neve, lowering her hands. She wished that she couldn't remember the boy so clearly, or rather the idea of him, his hand sprawled on the ground. She wished she could unsee it. Is that why I slept so long?
It's because you let 15 spirits walk through your body while you chatted with a dead boy, Mora replied tersely before Neve could speak, from what I've heard anyway.
Christ, is this what these leaves are supposed to smell like?
Blue turned to Neve, who continued to sip her tea with a sanguine air.
Is that true? Is it because spirits walk through me?
You did let them draw energy from you, Neve replied. You have quite a lot, but not that much.
Blue had two immediate thoughts about this. One was, I have quite a lot of energy. And the other was, I think I am annoyed. It was not as if she had intentionally allowed the spirits to draw power from her.
You should teach her to protect herself, Neve told Mora.
I have taught her some things. I'm not an entirely wretched mother, Mora said, handing Blue a cup of tea.
Blue said, I'm not trying this. It smells awful. She retrieved a cup of yogurt from the fridge. Then, in solidarity with her mother, she told Neve, I've never had to protect myself at the church watch before.
Neve mused. That's surprising. You amplify energy fields so much. I'm surprised they don't find you even here.
Oh, stop, Mora said, sounding irritable. There is nothing frightening about dead people.
Blue was still seeing Gansey's ghostly posture, defeated and bewildered. She said,
Mom, the church watch spirits, can you ever prevent their deaths by warning them?
The phone rang then. It shrilled twice and kept going, which meant Orla was still on the line with the other caller.
Damn Orla, Mora said, though Orla wasn't around to hear it.
I'll get it, Neve said.
Oh, but Mora didn't finish what she was going to say. Blue wondered if she was thinking that Neve normally worked for a lot more than a dollar a minute.
I know what you're thinking, her mother said after Neve had left the kitchen. Most of them die from heart attacks and cancer and other things that just can't be helped. That boy is going to die.
Blue was beginning to feel a phantom of the sensation she'd felt before, that strange grief.
I don't think an Aglinby boy will die from a heart attack. Why do you bother telling your clients?
So they can get their things in order and do everything they want to do before they die.
Her mother turned then, fixing Blue with a very knowing gaze.
She looked as impressive as someone could look when standing barefoot in jeans, holding a mug of tea reeking of rotting soil.
I'm not going to stop you from trying to warn him, Blue. But you need to know he's not going to believe you, even if you find him. And it's probably not going to save him, even if he knows. You might keep him from doing something stupid, or you might just ruin the last few months of his life.
You're a Pollyanna, Blue snapped, but she knew Mora was right, at least about the first part. Most everyone who met her thought her mother did parlor tricks for a living. What did Blue think she would do? Track down an Aglinby student, tap on the window of his Land Rover or Lexus, and warn him to have his brakes checked and life insurance policy updated?
I probably can't stop you from meeting him anyway, Mora said. I mean, if Neve is right about why you saw him, you're fated to meet him.
Fate, Blue replied, glowering at her mother, is a very weighty word to throw around before breakfast.
Everyone else, said Mora, had breakfast a very long time ago. The stairs creaked as Neve returned.
Wrong number, she said in her affectless way. Do you get many?
We're one number off from a gentleman escort company, Mora replied.
Ah, Neve said. That explains it.
Blue, she added as she settled back down at the table again.
If you'd like, I can try to see what killed him.
This got both Mora's and Blue's attention in a hurry.
Yes, Blue said.
Mora started to reply, then merely pressed her lips back together.
Neve asked, Do we have any grape juice?
Puzzled, Blue went to the fridge and held up a jug questioningly.
Cran grape? That will work fine.
Mora, her face still complicated, reached into the cupboard and drew out a dark blue salad bowl. She set it in front of Neve, not gently.
I won't be responsible for anything that you see, Mora said. Blue asked, What? What is that supposed to mean? Neither of them answered. With a soft smile on her soft face, Neve poured the juice into the bowl until it reached the edge. Mora turned off the light switch. The outside suddenly seemed vivid in comparison to the dim kitchen. The April bright trees pressed against the windows of the breakfast area, green leaf upon glass, and Blue was suddenly very aware of being surrounded by trees, of having a sense of being in the middle of a still wood. If you are going to watch, please be quiet, Neve remarked, looking at no one in particular. Blue jerked out a chair and sat. Mora leaned on the counter and crossed her arms. It was rare to see Mora upset but not doing something about it. Neve asked, What was his name again? He only said, Gansey. She felt self-conscious saying his name. Somehow the idea that she would have a hand in his life or his death made his nominal existence in this kitchen her responsibility. That's enough. Neve leaned over the bowl, her lips moving, her dark reflection moving slowly in the bowl. Blue kept thinking of what her mother had said. I won't be responsible for anything that you see. It made this thing that they did seem bigger than it usually felt, further away from a trick of nature and closer to a religion. Finally, Neve murmured. Though Blue couldn't hear any particular meaning in the wordless sound, Mora looked abruptly triumphant. Well, Neve said, this is a thing. She said it like, this is a thing, and Blue already knew how that turned out. What did you see? Blue asked. How did he die? Neve didn't take her eyes off Mora. She was asking a question somehow at the same time that she answered, I saw him, and then he disappeared into absolutely nothing. Mora flipped her hands. Blue knew the gesture well. Her mother had used it to end many an argument after she delivered a winning line. Only this time the winning line had been delivered by a bowl of cran grape juice, and Blue had no idea what it meant. Neve said, One moment he was there, and the next he didn't exist. It happens, Mora said, here in Henrietta. There is some place, or places, that I can't see. Other times, I see. And here she didn't look at Blue in such a way that Blue noticed that her mother was trying hard not to look at her. Things I wouldn't expect. Now Blue was recalling the countless times her mother had insisted that they stay in Henrietta even as it became more expensive to live here, even when opportunities to go to other towns opened up. Blue had once intercepted a set of emails on her mother's computer. One of Mora's male clients had ardently begged Mora to bring Blue and whatever else you cannot live without to his row house in Baltimore. In the reply, Mora had sternly informed him that this was not a possibility for many reasons, chief of which that she would not leave Henrietta and least of which that she didn't know if he was an axe murderer. He had emailed back only a sad face smiley. Blue always wondered what became of him. I would like to know what you saw, Blue said. What is nothing? Neve said, I was following the boy we saw last night to his death. I felt it was close chronologically, but then he disappeared into some place I couldn't see. I don't know how to explain it. I thought it was me.
It's not, Mora said. When she saw that Blue was still curious, she explained, It's like when there's no picture on the television, but you can tell it's still on. That's what it looks like. I've never seen someone go into it before, though.
Well, he went into it. Neve pushed the bowl away from her. You said that's not all. What else will that show me?
Mora said, channels that don't show up on basic cable.
Neve tapped her beautiful fingers on the table just once, and then she said, You didn't tell me about this before.
It didn't seem relevant, Mora replied.
A place where young men can disappear seems quite relevant.
Your daughter's skill also seems quite relevant.
Neve leveled her eternal gaze on Mora, who pushed off the counter and turned away.
I have work this afternoon, Blue said finally when she realized that the conversation had perished. The reflection of the leaves outside rippled slowly in the bowl, a forest still, but darkly.
"Are you really going to work in that?" Mora asked. Blue looked at her clothing. It involved a few thin layering shirts, including one she had altered using a method called shredding. "What's wrong with it?"
Mora shrugged. "Nothing. I always wanted an eccentric daughter. I just never realized how well my evil plans were working.
How late do you work?"
7. Well, probably later. Chialina is supposed to work until 7:30, but she's been saying all week that her brother got her tickets for evening, and if only someone would take over the last half hour.
You could say no.
What's evening? Is that the one where all the girls die with hatchets?
That's the one.
As Blue slurped down her yogurt, she spared a quick glance at Neve, who was still frowning at the bowl of juice, pushed just out of her reach.
Okay, I'm out.
She pushed back her chair. Mora was quiet in that heavy way that was louder than talking. Blue took her time tossing her yogurt into the trash can and dropping her spoon into the sink beside her mother. Then she turned to go upstairs for her shoes.
"Blue," Mora said finally, "I don't have to tell you not to kiss anyone, right?"
4.
Adam Parrish had been Gansey's friend for 18 months, and he knew that certain things came along with that friendship. Namely, believing in the supernatural, tolerating Gansey's troubled relationship with money, and coexisting with Gansey's other friends. The former two were problematic only when they took time away from Aglenby, and the latter was only problematic when it was Ronan Lynch. Gansey had once told Adam that he was afraid most people didn't know how to handle Ronan. What he meant by this was that he was worried that one day someone would fall on Ronan and cut themselves. Sometimes Adam wondered if Ronan had been like Ronan before the Lynch brothers' father had died, but only Gansey had known him then. Well, Gansey and Declan, but Declan seemed incapable of handling his brother now, which was why he'd been careful to schedule his visit while Ronan was in class. Outside of 1136 Monmouth, Adam waited on the second story landing with Declan and his girlfriend. Girlfriend, in fluttering white silk, looked a lot like Brianna, or Kaylee, or whoever Declan's last girlfriend had been. They all had blonde, shoulder-length hair and eyebrows that matched Declan's dark leather shoes. Declan, wearing the suit that his senior year political internship required, looked 30. Adam wondered if he would look that official in a suit, or if his childhood would betray him and render him ridiculous.
"Thanks for meeting us," Declan said.
Adam replied, "No problem."
Really, the reason he had agreed to walk with Declan's girlfriend from Aglenby had nothing to do with kindness and everything to do with a nagging hunch. Lately, Adam had felt as if someone had been looking in on their search for the ley line. He wasn't quite sure how to put this feeling into concrete terms. It was a stare caught out of the corner of his eye. A set of scuffed footprints in the stairwell that didn't seem to belong to any of the boys. A library clerk telling him an arcane text had been checked out by someone else right after he had returned it. He didn't want to trouble Gansey with it until he was certain, though. Things seemed to weigh heavily enough on Gansey as it was. It wasn't that Adam wondered if Declan was spying on them. Adam knew he was, but he believed that had everything to do with Ronan and nothing to do with the ley line. Still, it wouldn't hurt to do a bit of observation. Currently, girlfriend was glancing around in the furtive way that was more noticeable for its furtiveness. 1136 Monmouth was a hungry-looking brick factory, gutted and black-eyed, growing out of an overgrown lot that took up nearly all of a block. A clue to the building's original identity was painted on the eastern side of the building, Monmouth Manufacturing. But for all their research, neither Gansey nor Adam had been able to figure out precisely what Monmouth had manufactured. Something that had required 25-foot ceilings and wide open spaces. Something that had left moisture stains on the floor and gouges in the brick walls. Something that the world no longer needed. At the top of the second-floor staircase, Declan whispered all this knowledge into girlfriend's ear, and she giggled nervously as if it were a secret. Adam watched the way Declan's lip barely brushed the bottom of girlfriend's earlobe as he spoke to her. He looked away just as Declan glanced up. Adam was very good at watching without being watched.
Only Gansey ever seemed to catch him at it. Girlfriend pointed out the cracked window toward the lot below. Declan followed her gaze to the black, angry curves Gansey and Ronan had left doing donuts. Declan's expression hardened. Even if they were all Gansey's doing, he'd assume it was Ronan. Adam had knocked already, but he knocked again. One long, two short, his signal. "It will be messy," he apologized. This was more for the benefit of Declan's girlfriend than it was for Declan, who knew full well what state the apartment would be in. Adam suspected Declan somehow found the mess charming to outsiders. Declan was calculating, if anything. His goal was Ashley's virtue, and every step of tonight would have been planned with that in mind, even this brief stop at Monmouth Manufacturing. There was still no answer. "Should I call?" Declan asked. Adam tried the knob, which was locked, and then jimmied it with his knee, lifting the door on its hinges a bit. It swung open. Girlfriend made a noise of approval, but the success of the break-in had more to do with the door's failings than Adam's strengths. They stepped into the apartment, and girlfriend tipped her head back, back, back. The high ceiling soared above them, exposed iron beams holding up the roof. Gansey's invented apartment was a dreamer's laboratory. The entire second floor, thousands of square feet, spread out before them. Two of the walls were made up of old windows, dozens of tiny warped panes, except for a few clear ones Gansey had replaced. And the other two walls were covered with maps, the mountains of Virginia, of Wales, of Europe. Marker lines arced across each of them. Across the floor, a telescope peered at the western sky. At its feet lay piles of arcane electronics meant to measure magnetic activity. And everywhere, everywhere, there were books. Not the tidy stacks of an intellectual attempting to impress, but the slumping piles of a scholar obsessed. Some of the books weren't in English. Some of the books were dictionaries for the languages that some of the other books were in. Some of the books were actually Sports Illustrated swimsuit editions. Adam felt the familiar pang. Not jealousy, just wanting. One day, he'd have enough money to have a place like this. A place that looked on the outside like Adam looked on the inside. A small voice within Adam asked whether he would ever look this grand on the inside, or if it was something you had to be born into. Gansey was the way he was because he had lived with money when he was small, like a virtuoso placed at a piano bench as soon as he could sit. Adam, a latecomer, a usurper, still stumbled over his clumsy Henrietta accent and kept his change in a cereal box under his bed. Beside Declan, girlfriend held her hands to her chest in an unconscious reaction to masculine nakedness. In this case, the naked party was not a person, but a thing. Gansey's bed, nothing but two mattresses on a bare metal frame, sitting baldly in the middle of the room, barely made. It was somehow intimate in its complete lack of privacy. Gansey himself sat at an old desk with his back to them, gazing out an east-facing window and tapping a pen. His fat journal lay open near him, the pages fluttering with glued-in book passages and dark with notes. Adam was struck, as he occasionally was, by Gansey's agelessness. An old man in a young body, or a young man in an old man's life. "It's us," Adam said. When Gansey didn't reply, Adam led the way to his oblivious friend. Girlfriend made a variety of noises that all began with the letter O. With a variety of cereal boxes, packing containers, and house paint, Gansey had built a knee-high replica of the town of Henrietta in the center of the room, and so the three visitors were forced to walk down Main Street in order to reach the desk. Adam knew the truth. These buildings were a symptom of Gansey's insomnia, a new wall for every night awake. Adam stopped just beside Gansey. The area around him smelled strongly of mint from the leaf he chewed absently. Adam tapped the earbud in Gansey's right ear, and his friend startled. Gansey jumped to his feet. "Why, hello!" As always, there was an all-American war hero look to him, coated in his tousled brown hair, his summer-narrowed hazel eyes, the straight nose that ancient Anglo-Saxons had graciously passed on to him. Everything about him suggested valor and power and a firm handshake.
girlfriend stared. Adam remembered finding him intimidating when he first met him. There were two Ganseys, the one who lived inside his skin and the one Gansey put on in the morning when he slid his wallet into the back pocket of his chinos. The former was troubled and passionate, with no discernible accent to Adam's ears, and the latter bristled with latent power as he greeted people with the slippery, handsome accent of old Virginia money. It was a mystery to Adam how he could not seem to see both versions of Gansey at the same time. "I didn't hear you knock," Gansey said unnecessarily. He knocked fists with Adam. Coming from Gansey, the gesture was at once charming and self-conscious, a borrowed phrase of another language. "Ashley, this is Gansey," Declan said in his pleasant, neutral voice. It was a voice that reported tornado damage and cold fronts, narrated side effects of small blue pills, explained the safety procedures of the 747 we're flying in today. He added, "Dick Gansey?" If Gansey was thinking Declan's girlfriend was expendable, a renewable resource, he didn't show it. He merely said, voice just a little chilly as he corrected, "As Declan knows, it's my father who's Dick. For me, it's just Gansey." Ashley looked more shocked than amused. "Dick?" "Family name," Gansey said, with the weary air of someone trotting out a tired joke. "I try my best to ignore it."
"You're Aglenby, right? This place is crazy. Why don't you live on the school grounds?" Ashley asked.
"Because I own this building," Gansey said. "It's a better investment than paying for dorm housing. You can't sell your dorm after you're done with school. And where did that money go? Nowhere."
Dick Gansey III hated to be told that he sounded like Dick Gansey II, but right then he did. Both of them could trot out logic on a nice little leash, wearing a smart plaid jacket when they wanted to.
"God," Ashley remarked. She glanced at Adam. Her eyes didn't linger, but still he remembered the fray on the shoulder of his sweater.
"Don't pick at it. She's not looking at it. No one else notices it."
With effort, Adam squared his shoulders and tried to inhabit the uniform as easily as Gansey or Ronan.
"Ash, you won't believe why Gansey came here, of all places," Declan said. "Tell her, Gansey."
Gansey couldn't resist talking about Glendower. He never could. He asked, "How much do you know about Welsh kings?" Ashley pursed her lips, her fingers pinching the skin at the base of her throat.
Llewellyn? Glendower? English marcher lords?"
The smile on Gansey's face could have lit coal mines. Adam hadn't known about Llewellyn or Glendower when he'd first met Gansey. Gansey had needed to describe how Owen Glendower to non-Welsh speakers, a medieval Welsh noble, had fought against the English for Welsh freedom and then, when capture seemed inevitable, disappeared from the island and from history altogether. But Gansey never minded retelling the story. He'd related the events like they'd just happened, thrilled again by the magical signs that had accompanied Glendower's birth, the rumors of his power of invisibility, the impossible victories against larger armies, and finally, his mysterious escape. When Gansey spoke, Adam saw the green swell of the Welsh foothills, the wide, glistening surface of the River Dee, the unforgiving northern mountains that Glendower vanished into. In Gansey's stories, Owain Glyndŵr could never die. Listening to him tell the story now, it was clear to Adam that Glendower was more than a historical figure to Gansey. He was everything Gansey wished he could be, wise and brave, sure of his path, touched by the supernatural, respected by all, survived by his legacy. Gansey, now fully warmed to his tale, enchanted again by the mystery of it, asked Ashley, "Have you heard of the legends of sleeping kings? The legends that heroes like Llewellyn and Glendower and Arthur aren't really dead, but are instead sleeping in tombs, waiting to be woken up?" Ashley blinked vapidly, then said,
"Sounds like a metaphor."
Perhaps she wasn't as dumb as they'd thought.
"Maybe so," Gansey said. He made a grandiose gesture to the maps on the wall, covered with the ley lines he believed Glendower had traveled along. Sweeping up the journal behind him, he paged through maps and notes as examples. "I think Glendower's body was brought over to the New World,
specifically here, Virginia. I want to find where he's buried."
To Adam's relief, Gansey left out the part about how he believed the legends that said Glendower was still alive centuries later. He left out the part about how he believed the eternally sleeping Glendower would grant a favor to whoever woke him. He left out the part about how it haunted him, this need to find this long-lost king. He left out the midnight phone calls to Adam when he couldn't sleep for obsessing about his search. He left out the microfiche and the museums, the newspaper features and the metal detectors, the frequent flyer miles and the battered foreign language phrase books. And he left out all the parts about magic and the ley line.
"That's crazy," Ashley said. Her eyes were locked on the journal. "Why do you think he's here?"
There were two possible versions of this answer. One was grounded merely in history and was infinitely suitable for general consumption. The other added divining rods and magic to the equation. Some days, some rotten days, Adam believed the former, and only barely. But being Gansey's friend meant that more often he hoped for the latter. This was where Ronan, much to Adam's dissatisfaction, excelled. His belief in the supernatural explanation was unwavering. Adam's faith was imperfect. Ashley, either because she was transient or because she'd been deemed skeptical, got the historical version. In his best professor voice, Gansey explained a bit about Welsh place names in the area, 15th century artifacts found buried in Virginia soil, and historical support for an early pre-Columbus Welsh landing in America. Midway through the lecture, Noah, Monmouth Manufacturing's reclusive third resident, emerged from a meticulous room directly next to the office Ronan had claimed as his bedroom. Noah's bed shared the tiny space with a piece of mysterious equipment Adam guessed was some sort of printing press. Noah, stepping farther into the room, didn't so much smile at Ashley as goggle at her. He wasn't the best with new people.
"That's Noah," Declan said.
He said it in a way that confirmed Adam's assumption. Monmouth Manufacturing and the boys who lived in it were a tourist stop for Declan and Ashley, a conversation piece for a later dinner. Noah extended his hand.
"Oh, your hand is cold."
Ashley cupped her fingers against her shirt to warm them.
"I've been dead for 7 years," Noah said. "That's as warm as they get."
Noah, unlike his pristine room, always seemed a little grubby. There was something out of place about his clothing, his mostly combed back, fair hair. His unkempt uniform always made Adam feel a little less like he stuck out.
It was hard to feel like part of the Aglenby crowd when standing next to Gansey, whose crisp as George Washington white-collared shirt alone cost more than Adam's bicycle.
Anyone who said you couldn't tell the difference between a shirt from the mall and a shirt made by a clever Italian man had never seen the latter. Or even Ronan, who had spent $900 on a tattoo merely to piss off his brother.
Ashley's obliging giggle was cut off as Ronan's bedroom door opened. A cloud like there would never be sun again crossed Declan's face. Ronan and Declan Lynch were undeniably brothers with the same dark brown hair and sharp nose, but Declan was solid where Ronan was brittle. Declan's wide jaw and smile said, "Vote for me," while Ronan's buzzed head and thin mouth warned that this species was poisonous.
"Ronan," Declan said. On the phone with Adam earlier, he had asked, "When will Ronan not be available?"
"I thought you had tennis."
"I did," Ronan replied. There was a moment of silence where Declan considered what he wanted to say in front of Ashley, and Ronan enjoyed the effect that awkward silence had on his brother. The two elder Lynch brothers, there were three total at Aglenby, had been at odds for as long as Adam had known them. Unlike most of the world, Gansey preferred Ronan to his elder brother Declan, and so the lines had been drawn. Adam suspected Gansey's preference was because Ronan was earnest, even if he was horrible, and with Gansey, honesty was golden. Declan waited a second too long to speak, and Ronan crossed his arms over his chest.
"You've got quite the guy here, Ashley. You'll have a great night with him, and then some other girl can have a great night with him tomorrow." A fly buzzed against a window pane far above their heads. Behind Ronan, his door, covered with photocopies of his speeding tickets, drifted closed.
Ashley's mouth didn't make an O so much as a sideways D. A second too late, Gansey punched Ronan in the arm.
"He's sorry," Gansey said.
Ashley's mouth was slowly closing. She blinked at the map of Wales and back to Ronan. He'd chosen his weapon well. Only the truth, untempered by kindness.
"My brother is," said Declan, but he didn't finish. There wasn't anything he could say that Ronan hadn't already proven.
He said, "We're going now, Ronan. I think you need to reconsider your..." But again, he had no words to end the sentence. His brother had taken all the catchy ones. Declan snagged Ashley's hand, jerking her attention away and toward the apartment door.
"Declan," Gansey started. "Don't try to make this better," Declan warned.
As he pulled Ashley out into the tiny stairwell and down the stairs, Adam heard the beginnings of damage control.
"He has problems, I told you. I tried to make sure he wouldn't be here. He's the one who found Dad. It messed him up. Let's go get seafood instead. Don't you think we look like lobster tonight?" "We do."
The moment the apartment door was closed, Gansey said, "Come on, Ronan." Ronan's expression was still incendiary. His code of honor left no room for infidelity, for casual relationships. It wasn't that he didn't condone them. He couldn't understand them.
"So he's a man whore. It's not your problem," Gansey said. Ronan was not really Gansey's problem either, in Adam's opinion, but they'd had this argument before.
One of Ronan's eyebrows was raised, sharp as a razor. Gansey strapped his journal closed.
"That doesn't work on me.
She had nothing to do with you and Declan." He said "you and Declan" like it was a physical object, something you could pick up and look underneath.
"You treated her badly. You made the rest of us look bad."
Ronan looked chastened, but Adam knew better. Ronan wasn't sorry for his behavior. He was only sorry that Gansey had been there to see him. What lived between the Lynch brothers was dark enough to hide anyone else's feelings. But surely Gansey knew that as well as Adam. He ran his thumb back and forth across his bottom lip, a habit he never seemed to notice and Adam never bothered to point out. Catching Adam's gaze, he said, "Christ, now I feel dirty. Come on, let's go to Nino's. We'll get pizza and I'll call that psychic and the whole goddamn world will sort itself out." This was why Adam could forgive that shallow, glossy version of Gansey he'd first met. Because of his money and his good family name, because of his handsome smile and his easy laugh, because he liked people and despite his fears to the contrary, they liked him back, Gansey could have had any and all of the friends that he wanted. Instead, he had chosen the three of them. Three guys who should have, for three different reasons, been friendless.
"I'm not coming," Noah said.
"Need some more alone time?" Ronan asked.
"Ronan," Gansey interjected, "set your weapons to stun, will you? Noah, we won't make you eat. Adam?"
Adam glanced up, distracted. His mind had wandered from Ronan's bad behavior to Ashley's interest in the journal, and he was wondering if it was more than the ordinary curiosity people possessed when faced with Gansey and his obsessive accessories.
He knew Gansey would find him overly suspicious, unnecessarily proprietary of a search Gansey was more than willing to share with most people.
But Gansey and Adam sought Glendower for different reasons. Gansey longed for him like Arthur longed for the Grail, drawn by a desperate but nebulous need to be useful to the world, to make sure his life meant something beyond champagne parties and white collars, by some complicated longing to settle an argument that waged deep inside himself. Adam, on the other hand, needed that royal favor. And that meant they needed to be the ones to wake Glendower. They needed to be the ones to find him first.
"Parrish?" Gansey repeated. "Come on."
Adam made a face. He felt it would take more than pizza to improve Ronan's character. But Gansey was already grabbing the car keys to the pig and stepping around his miniature Henrietta. Even though Ronan was snarling and Noah was sighing and Adam was hesitating, he didn't turn to verify that they were coming. He knew they were. In three different ways, he'd earned them all, days or weeks or months before, and when it came to it, they'd all follow him anywhere.
"Excelsior," said Gansey, and shut the door behind them.
5. Barrington Welk was feeling less than sprightly as he slouched down the hall of Whitman House, the Aglenby admin building. It was 5 p.m., the school day well over, and he'd only left his townhouse in order to pick up homework that had to be graded before the next day. Afternoon light spilled in the tall, many-paned windows to his left. On the right was a hum of voices from the staff offices. These old buildings looked like museums at this time of day.
"Barrington, I thought you were out today. You look terrible. You sick?"
Welk didn't immediately formulate an answer. For all intents and purposes, he was still out. The question-asker was Jonah Milo, the well-scrubbed 11th and 12th grade English teacher. Despite an affinity for plaid and thin-legged corduroy pants, Milo wasn't unbearable, but Welk didn't care to discuss his absence from class this morning with him. St. Mark's Eve was beginning to have a sheen of tradition for him, one that involved spending most of the night getting smashed before falling asleep on his kitchenette floor just before dawn. This year, he'd had the forethought to request St. Mark's Day off. Teaching Latin to Aglenby boys was punishment enough. Teaching it with a hangover was excruciating. Finally, Welk merely held up the grubby stack of handwritten homework assignments as answer. Milo widened his eyes at the sight of the name written on the topmost paper.
"Ronan Lynch? Is that his homework?"
Flipping the stack around to read the name on the front, Welk agreed that it was. As he did, a few boys on their way to crew team practice crashed past, pushing him into Milo. The students probably didn't even realize they were being disrespectful. Welk was barely older than they were, and his dramatically large features made him look younger. It was still easy to mistake him for one of the students. Milo disentangled himself from Welk.
"How do you get him to come to class?"
The mere mention of Ronan Lynch's name had scraped something raw inside Welk. Because it was never Ronan by himself, it was Ronan as part of the inseparable threesome. Ronan Lynch, Richard Gansey, and Adam Parrish. All of the boys in his class were affluent, confident, arrogant, but the three of them, more than anyone else, reminded him of what he'd lost. Welk struggled to remember if Ronan had ever missed a class with him. The days of the school year blurred together, one long and unending day that began with Welk parking his crappy car next to the beautiful Aglenby cars, shouldering his way past laughing, thoughtless boys, standing in front of a room of students who were glassy-eyed at best and derisive at worst. And at the end of the day, Welk, alone and haunted, never, ever able to forget that he was once one of them. When did this become my life? Welk shrugged.
"I don't remember him skipping."
"You have him with Gansey, though, don't you?" Milo asked. "That explains it. Those two are tight as ticks."
It was a strange old expression, one that Welk hadn't heard since his own days at Aglenby, when he too had been tight as ticks with his roommate, Cherney. He felt a hollowness inside him, like he was hungry, like he should have stayed home and drank more to commemorate this miserable day. He swam back to the present, looking at the attendance sheet the substitute teacher had left.
"Ronan was in class today, but Gansey wasn't. Not in mine, anyway."
"Oh, that's probably because of that St. Mark's Day hoopla he was talking about," Milo said.
This got Welk's attention. No one knew that today was St. Mark's Day. No one celebrated St. Mark's Day, not even St. Mark's mother. Only Welk and Cherney, treasure hunters and troublemakers, cared about its existence. Welk said, "Beg pardon?" "I don't know what all's going on," Milo replied. One of the other teachers said hi to him on the way out of the staff room, and Milo looked over his shoulder to reply. Welk imagined grabbing Milo's arm, forcing his attention back his way. It took all of his effort to wait instead. Turning back around, Milo seemed to sense Welk's interest because he added,
"He hasn't talked to you about it. He wouldn't shut up about it yesterday. It's that ley line stuff he's always on about."
Ley line. If no one knew about St. Mark's Day, truly no one knew about ley lines. Certainly no one in Henrietta, Virginia. Certainly not one of Aglenby's richest pupils. Definitely not in conjunction with St. Mark's Day.
This was Welk's quest, Welk's treasure, Welk's teen years.
Why was Richard Gansey III talking about it?
With the words ley line spoken aloud, a memory was conjured. Welk in a dense wood, sweat collected on his upper lip. He was 17 and shivering. Every time his heart beat, red lines streaked in the corners of his vision, the trees darkening with his pulse. It made the leaves seem like they were all moving, though there was no wind. Cherney was on the ground, not dead, but dying. His legs still pedaled on the uneven surface beside his red car, making drifts of fallen leaves behind him. His face was just done. In Welk's head, unearthly voices hissed and whispered, words blurred and stretched together.
Some sort of energy source or something, Milo said.
Welk was suddenly afraid that Milo could see the memory on him, could hear the inexplicable voices in his head, incomprehensible but nonetheless present ever since that failed day. Welk schooled his features, though what he was really thinking was, if someone else is looking here, I must have been right. It must be here.
What did he say he was doing with the ley line? He asked with studied calm.
I don't know. Ask him about it. I'm sure he'd love to talk your ear off about it.
Milo looked over his shoulder as the secretary joined them in the hall, her bag on her arm, her jacket in her hand. Her eyeliner was smudged after a long day in the office.
We talking about Gansey III and his New Age obsession? The secretary asked.
She had a pencil stuck in her hair to keep it up, and Welk stared at the stray strands that wound up around the lead. It was clear to him from the way she stood that she secretly found Milo attractive, despite the plaid and the corduroy and the beard. She asked,
"Do you know how much Gansey Sr. is worth? I wonder if he knows what his kid spends all his time on. Man, sometimes these entitled little bastards make me want to slit my wrists. Jonah, are you coming with me for a smoke break or not?"
"I quit," said Milo. He cast a quick, uneasy glance from the secretary to Welk, and Welk knew he was thinking about how much Welk's father had been worth once upon a time, and how little he was worth now, long after the trials had left the front pages of the newspapers. All the junior faculty and the admin staff hated the Aglimby boys, hated them for what they had and what they stood for, and Welk knew they were all secretly pleased that he had fallen down among their ranks.
"How about you, Barry?" the secretary asked. Then she answered her own question.
"No, you don't smoke. You're too pretty for that. Oh, well, I'll go myself."
Milo turned to go as well.
"Feel better,"
he said kindly, although Welk had never said he was sick. The voices in Welk's head were a roar, but for once his own thoughts had drowned them out.
"I think I do already," said Welk. It was possible that Cherney's death wasn't for nothing after all.
6.
Blue wouldn't really describe herself as a waitress. After all, she also taught penmanship to third graders, made wreaths for the Society for Ladies of Perpetual Health, walked dogs that belonged to inhabitants of Henrietta's poshest condo complex, and replaced bedding plants for the elderly ladies of their neighborhood. Really, being a waitress at Nino's was the least of things she did. But the hours were flexible. It was the most legitimate-looking entry on her already bizarre resume, and it certainly paid the best. There was really only one problem with Nino's, and it was that for all practical purposes, it belonged to Aglimby. The restaurant was 6 blocks over from the iron-gated Aglimby campus at the very edge of the historic downtown. It wasn't the nicest place in Henrietta. There were others with bigger televisions and louder music, but none of them had managed to grip the school's imagination like Nino's. Just to know that Nino's was the place to be was a rite of passage. If you could be seduced by Morton's Sports Bar on 3rd, you didn't deserve to be in the inner circle. So the Aglimby boys at Nino's were not just Aglimby students, but they were the most Aglimby that the school had to offer. Loud, pushy, entitled. Blue had seen enough of the Raven boys to last a lifetime. Tonight, the music was already loud enough to paralyze the finer parts of her personality. She tied on her apron, tuned out the Beastie Boys as best she could, and put her tip-earning smile on. Close to the beginning of her shift, four boys came through the front door, letting a cold hiss of fresh air into the room that smelled of oregano and beer. In the window beside the boys, a neon light that said, "Since 1976, lit their faces a limesickle green. The boy in front was talking on his cell phone, even as he showed Chialina four fingers to indicate party size. Raven boys were good at multitasking, so long as all tasks were exclusively to benefit themselves. As Chialina hurried by, her apron pocket stuffed with tickets to deliver, Blue handed her four greasy menus. Chialina's hair floated above her head with static electricity and abject stress. Blue asked, very unwilling, "Do you want me to take that table?" "Are you kidding?" Chialina replied, eyeing the four boys. Having finally ended his call, the first one slid into one of the orange vinyl booths. The tallest of them knocked his head on the green cut glass light hanging over the table. The others laughed generously at him. He said, "Bitch." A tattoo snaked out above his collar as he swiveled to sit down. There was something hungry about all of the boys. Blue didn't want them anyway. What she wanted was a job that wouldn't suck all the thoughts out of her head and replace them with the leering call of a synthesizer. Sometimes Blue would creep outside for an infinitesimal break, and as she lay her head back against the brick wall of the alley behind the restaurant, she'd dream idly about careers studying tree rings, swimming with manta rays, scouring Costa Rica to find out more about the scale-crested pygmy tyrant. Really, she didn't know if she'd truly like to find out more about the pygmy tyrant. She just liked the name, because for a 5-foot-tall girl, pygmy tyrant sounded like a career. All of those imagined lives seemed pretty far away from Nino's. Just a few minutes after Blue's shift began, the manager signaled to Blue from the kitchen. Tonight, it was Donnie. Nino's had about 15 managers, all of them related to the owner and none of them high school graduates. Donnie managed to both lounge and offer the phone at once. "Your parent, mother?" But there was no need to clarify because Blue didn't really know who her other parent was. Actually, she'd tried to pester Maura about her father before, but her mother had neatly slithered out of that line of questioning. Plucking the phone from Donnie's hand, Blue tucked herself back into the corner of the kitchen, next to a terminally greasy fridge and a large basin sink. Despite her care, she still got jostled every few moments. "Mom, I'm working." "Don't panic. Are you sitting?" "You probably don't need to sit." "Well, possibly. At least lean on something." "He called to schedule a reading." "Who, Mom? Speak louder. It's loud here." "Ganzi." For a moment, Blue didn't understand. Then realization tumbled down, weighting her feet. Her voice was a bit faint. "When did you schedule it for?"
"Tomorrow afternoon. It was the fastest I could get him in. I tried to get him in sooner, but he said he had school. Do you have a shift tomorrow?"
"I'm changing it," Blue replied immediately. It was someone else saying the words, though. The real Blue was back in the churchyard, hearing his voice say, "Ganzi."
"Yes, you are. Go work."
As she hung up, she could feel her pulse fluttering. It was real. He was real. It was all true and terribly, terribly specific. It seemed foolish to be here now, bussing tables and filling drinks and smiling at strangers. She wanted to be home, leaning back against the cool bark of the spreading beech tree behind the house, trying to decide what this changed about her life. Neve had said this was the year she'd fall in love. Moore had said that she'd kill her true love if she kissed him. Ganzi was supposed to die this year. What were the odds? Ganzi had to be her true love. He had to be, because there was no way she was going to kill someone. Is this the way life is supposed to be? Maybe it would be better not to know. Something touched her shoulder. Touching was strictly against Blue's policy.
No one was to touch her person while she was at Nino's, and especially no one was to touch her now when she was having a crisis. She whirled. "Can I help you?" Before her stood the multitasking cell phone Aglenby boy, looking tidy and presidential. His watch looked as if it cost more than her mother's car, and every area of exposed skin was a flattering shade of tan. Blue had never figured out how Aglenby boys managed to tan earlier than locals. It probably had something to do with things like spring break and places like Costa Rica and the Spanish coast. President's cell phone had probably been closer to a pygmy tyrant than she would ever be. "I certainly hope so," he said in a way that indicated less hope and more certainty. He had to speak loudly to be heard, and he had to incline his head to meet her eyes. There was something annoyingly impressive about him, an impression that he was very tall, although he was no taller than most boys. "My socially inhibited friend, Adam, thinks you're cute, but he's unwilling to make a move. Over there. Not the smudgy one. Not the sulky one." Blue, largely against her will, glanced to the booth he pointed to. Three boys sat at it. One was smudgy, just as he said, with a rumpled, faded look about his person, like his body had been laundered too many times. The one who'd hit the light was handsome, and his head was shaved, a soldier in a war where the enemy was everyone else. And the third was elegant. It was not the right word for him, but it was close. He was fine-boned and a little fragile-looking, with blue eyes pretty enough for a girl. Despite her better instincts, Blue felt a flutter of interest. "So?" she asked. "So would you do me a favor and come over and talk to him?" Blue used 1 millisecond of her time to imagine what that might be like, throwing herself at a booth of Raven boys and wading through awkward, vaguely sexist conversation. Despite the comeliness of the boy in the booth, it was not a pleasant millisecond. "What exactly is it you think I'm going to talk to him about?" President's cell phone looked unconcerned. "We'll think of something. We're interesting people." Blue doubted it, but the elegant boy was rather elegant, and he looked genuinely horrified that his friend was talking to her, which was slightly endearing. For one brief moment that she was later ashamed of and bemused by, Blue considered telling President's cell phone when her shift ended. But then Donnie called her name from the kitchen, and she remembered rules number 1 and 2. She said, "Do you see how I'm wearing this apron? It means I'm working for a living." The unconcerned expression didn't flag. He said, "I'll take care of it." She echoed, "Take care of it?" "Yeah. How much do you make in an hour?" "I'll take care of it, and I'll talk to your manager." For a moment, Blue was actually lost for words. She had never believed people who claimed to be speechless, but she was. She opened her mouth, and at first all that came out was air. Then something like the beginning of a laugh. Then finally she managed to sputter, "I am not a prostitute." The Aglenby boy appeared puzzled for a long moment, and then realization dawned. "Oh, that was not how I meant it. That is not what I said." "That is what you said. You think you can just pay me to talk to your friend? Clearly you pay most of your female companions by the hour and don't know how it works with the real world. But, Blue remembered that she was working to a point, but not what that point was. Indignation had eliminated all higher functions, and all that remained was the desire to slap him. The boy opened his mouth to protest, and her thought came back to her all in a rush. "Most girls, when they're interested in a guy, will sit with them for free." To his credit, the Aglenby boy didn't speak right away. Instead, he thought for a moment, and then he said without heat, "You said you were working for a living. I thought it'd be rude to not take that into account. I'm sorry you're insulted. I see where you're coming from, but I feel it's a little unfair that you're not doing the same for me." "I feel you're being condescending," Blue said. In the background, she caught a glimpse of Soldier Boy making a plane of his hand. It was crashing and weaving toward the table surface while Smudgy Boy gulped laughter down. The elegant boy held his palm over his face in exaggerated horror, fingers spread just enough that she could see his wince. "Dear God," remarked Cell Phone Boy,
I don't know what else to say.
Sorry, she recommended.
I said that already.
Blue considered.
Then bye.
He made a little gesture at his chest that she thought was supposed to mean he was curtsying or bowing or something sarcastically gentlemanlike. Calla would have flipped him off, but Blue just stuffed her hands in her apron pockets. As President's cell phone headed back to his table and picked up a fat leather journal that seemed incongruous with the rest of him, the soldier boy let out a derisive laugh and she heard him mimic, "Not a prostitute." Beside him, the elegant boy ducked his head. His ears were bright pink. Not for $100, Blue thought. Not for $200. But she had to confess she was a little undone by the blushing ears. It didn't seem very Aglinby. Did Raven boys get embarrassed? She'd stared a moment too long. The elegant boy looked up and caught her gaze. His eyebrows were drawn together, remorseful rather than cruel, making her doubt herself. But then she flushed, hearing again President Cell Phone's voice saying, "I'll take care of it." She shot him a foul look, a real Calla number, and whirled back toward the kitchen. Neve had to be wrong. She'd never fall in love with one of them.
7.
"Tell me again," Gansey asked Adam, "why you think a psychic is a good idea?" The pizzas had been demolished, no help from Noah, which made Gansey feel better and Ronan feel worse. By the end of the meal, Ronan had picked off all his moving dolly scabs, and he would have picked off Adams as well if he'd let him. Gansey sent him outside to blow off steam and Noah to babysit him. Now Gansey and Adams stood in line while a woman argued about mushroom topping with the cashier.
"They deal in energy work," said Adam, just loud enough to be heard over the blaring music. He studied his arm where he'd worried his own scab off. The skin beneath looked a little angry. Looking up, he peered over his shoulder, probably looking for the evil, not a prostitute, waitress.
Part of Gansey felt guilty for botching Adam's chances with her. The other part felt he'd possibly saved Adam from having his spinal cord ripped out and devoured. It was possible, Gansey thought, that he'd once again been oblivious about money. He hadn't meant to be offensive, but in retrospect, it was possible he had been. This was going to eat at him all evening. He vowed, as he had 100 times before, to consider his words better. Adam continued, "The ley lines, her energy, energy and energy."
"Matchy, matchy," Gansey replied, "if the psychic is for real."
Adam said, "Beggars can't be choosers." Gansey looked at the handwritten ticket for the pizza in his hand. According to the bubbly writing, their waitress's name had been Chialina. She'd included her telephone number, but it was hard to say which boy she'd been hoping to attract. Some of the parties at the table were less dangerous to consort with than others. She clearly hadn't found him condescending, which was probably because she hadn't heard him speak. All night, this was going to bother him. All night. He said, "I wish we had a sense of how wide the lines were. I don't know if we're looking for a thread or a highway, even after all this time. We could have been feet away from it and never known." Adam's neck might have broken from all the looking around he was doing. There was still no sign of the waitress. He looked tired, up too late, too many nights in a row working and studying. Gansey hated seeing him like this, but nothing he thought of in his head sounded like something he could actually say to him. Adam wouldn't tolerate pity.
"We know they can be doused, so they can't be that narrow," Adam said.
He rubbed the back of his hand against his temple. That was what had brought Gansey to Henrietta in the first place. Months of dowsing and research. Later, he'd tried to douse the line more precisely with Adam. They'd circled the town with a willow divining rod and an electromagnetic frequency reader, swapping the instruments between the two of them. The machine had spiked strangely a few times, and Gansey had thought he'd felt the divining rod twitch in his hands in time with it, but it might have been wishful thinking by that point. "I could tell him his grades are going to go to hell if he doesn't cut back on his hours," Gansey thought, looking at the dark skin beneath Adam's eyes. If he made it about him, Adam wouldn't interpret it as charity. He considered how to frame it so that it sounded selfish. "You're no good to me if you get mono or something," Adam would see through that in a second. Instead, Gansey said, "We need a solid point A before we even start thinking about point B." But they had point A. They even had point B. The problem was just that the points were too large. Gansey had a map torn from a book depicting Virginia with the ley line marked darkly across it. Like the ley line enthusiasts in the UK, American ley line seekers determined key spiritual places and drew lines between them until the arc of the ley line became obvious. It seemed like all the work had been done for them already. But the creators of those maps had never meant for them to be used as road maps. They were too approximate. One of the maps listed merely New York City, Washington, D.C., and Pilot Mountain, North Carolina as possible reference points. Each of those points was miles wide, and even the finest of pencil lines drawn on a map was no narrower than 35 feet, even eliminating the possibilities left them with thousands of acres where the ley line could be, thousands of acres where Glendower could be, if he was along the ley line at all. "I wonder," Adam mused aloud, "if we could electrify either the rods or the line, hook up a car battery to them or something. If you got a loan, you could stop working until after college." No, that would immediately birth an argument. Gansey shook his head a little, more at his own thoughts than at Adam's comment. He said, "That sounds like either the beginning of a torture session or a music video." Adam's searching for devil waitress face had given way to his brilliant idea face. The fatigue melted away. "Well, amplification, that's all I was thinking. Something to make it louder and easier to follow." It wasn't an awful idea. Last year in Montana, Gansey had interviewed a lightning strike victim. The boy had been sitting on his ATV in the doorway of a cattle barn when he was struck, and the incident had left him with an inexplicable fear of being indoors and an uncanny ability to follow one of the western ley lines using only a bent bit of radio antenna. For 2 days, they trailed together across fields carved by glaciers and marked by round hay bales higher than their heads, finding hidden water sources and tiny caves and lightning-burned stumps and strangely marked stones. Gansey had tried to convince the boy to come back to the East Coast to perform his same miracle on the ley line there, but the boy's newly pathological fear of the indoors ruled out all plane and car travel. And it was a long walk. Still, it wasn't an entirely useless exercise. It was further proof of the amorphous theory Adam had just described. Ley lines and electricity could be linked. Energy and energy. Matchy, matchy. As he moved up to the counter, Gansey became aware that Noah was lurking at his elbow, looking strained and urgent. Both were typical for Noah, so Gansey was not immediately troubled. He passed a folded-over packet of bills to the cashier. Noah continued to hover. "Noah, what?" demanded Gansey. Noah seemed about to put his hands in his pockets and then didn't. Noah's hands seemed to belong fewer places than other people's. He eventually just let them hang as he looked at Gansey. He said, "Declan's here." An immediate scan of the restaurant offered nothing. Gansey demanded, "Where?" "Parking lot," Noah said. "He and Ronan." Not bothering to wait for the rest of the sentence, Gansey burst out into the black evening. Scrambling around the side of the building, he skidded onto the parking lot just in time to see Ronan throw a punch. The swing was infinite. From the looks of it, it was the opening act. In the sickly green light of a buzzing street lamp, Ronan had an unbreakable stance and an expression hard as granite. There was no wavering in the line of the blow. He had accepted the consequences of wherever his fist landed long before he began the punch. From his father, Gansey had gotten a head for logic, an affection for research, and a trust fund the size of most state lotteries. From their father, the Lynch brothers had gotten indefatigable egos, a decade of obscure Irish music instrument lessons, and the ability to box like they meant it. Neil Lynch had not been around very much, but when he had been an excellent teacher. "Ronan!" Gansey shouted too late. Declan went down, but before Gansey even had time to form a plan of action, he was back up again, fist smacking into his brother. Ronan released a string of profanity so varied and pointed that Gansey was amazed that the words alone didn't slay Declan. Arms windmilled, knees met chests, elbows rammed into faces. Then Ronan grabbed Declan's suit coat and used it to throw him onto the mirror-like hood of Declan's Volvo. "Not the fucking car," snarled Declan, his lip bloody. The story of the Lynch family was this. Once upon a time, a man named Neil Lynch had three sons, one of whom loved his father more than the others. Neil Lynch was handsome and charismatic and rich and mysterious, and one day he was dragged from his charcoal-gray BMW and beaten to death with a tire iron. It was a Wednesday. On Thursday, his son Ronan found his body in the driveway. On Friday, their mother stopped speaking and never spoke again. On Saturday, the Lynch brothers found that their father's death left them rich and homeless. The will forbade them to touch anything in the house, their clothing, the furniture, their silent mother. The will demanded they immediately move into Aglenby housing. Declan, the eldest, was meant to control the funds and their lives until his brothers reached 18. On Sunday, Ronan stole his deceased father's car. On Monday, the Lynch brothers stopped being friends. Ripping Ronan from the Volvo, Declan hit his brother hard enough that even Gansey felt it. Ashley, her light hair more visible than the rest of her, blinked at him from inside the Volvo. Gansey took several strides across the lot. "Ronan!" Ronan didn't even turn his head. A grim smile, more skeleton than boy, was etched onto his mouth as the brothers whirled around. This was a real fight, not for show, and it played in fast forward. Someone would be unconscious before Gansey had time to cry havoc, and he just didn't have time to take someone to the ER tonight. Gansey sprang, seizing Ronan's arm in mid-swing. Ronan still had his fingers hooked inside Declan's mouth, though, and Declan already had a fist flying from behind like a violent embrace. So it was Gansey who got Declan's blow. Something wet misted his arm. He was fairly certain it was spit, but it was possible it was blood. He shouted a word he'd learned from his sister Helen. Ronan had Declan by the knot of his burgundy tie, and Declan gripped the back of his brother's skull with one white-knuckled hand. Gansey might as well have not been there. With a neat flick of his wrist, Ronan smacked Declan's head off the driver's side door of the Volvo. It made a sick, wet sound. Declan's hand fell away. Gansey seized the opportunity to propel Ronan about 5 feet away. Jerking in his grip, Ronan jackrabbited his legs on the pavement. He was unbelievably strong. "Quit it," Gansey panted. "You're ruining your face." Ronan twisted, all muscle and adrenaline. Declan, his suit looking more bedraggled than any suit ought to look, started back toward them. He had a hell of a bruise rising on his temple, but he looked ready to go again. There was no way of telling what had set them off. A new home nurse for their mother? A poor grade at school? An unexplained credit card bill? Maybe just Ashley. Across the lot, the manager of Nino's emerged from the front entrance. It wouldn't be long before the cops were called. Where was Adam? "Declan," Gansey said, voice full of warning, "if you come back over here, I swear." With a jerk of his chin, Declan spit blood at the pavement. His lip was bleeding, but his teeth were still good.
"Fine. He's your dog, Gansey. You leash him. Keep him from getting kicked out of Aglenby. I wash my hands of him."
"I wish," snarled Ronan. His entire body was rigid under Gansey's hand. He wore his hatred like a cruel second skin. Declan said, "You're such a piece of shit, Ronan. If Dad saw..." And this made Ronan burst forward again. Gansey clamped arms around Ronan's chest and dragged him back. "Why are you even here?" Gansey asked Declan.
"Ashley had to use the bathroom," Declan replied crisply. "I should be able to stop where I like, don't you think?"
The last time Gansey had been in the Nino's co-ed bathroom, it had smelled like vomit and beer. On one of the walls, a red Sharpie had scrawled the word Beelzebub and Ronan's number below. It was hard to imagine Declan choosing to inflict Nino's facilities on his girlfriend. Gansey's voice was short. "I think you should just go. This isn't getting solved tonight." Declan laughed, just once, a big careless laugh full of round vowels. He clearly found nothing about Ronan funny.
"Ask him if he's going to get by with a B this year," he told Gansey. "Do you ever go to class, Ronan?"
Behind Declan, Ashley peered out of the driver's side window. She'd rolled down the window to listen. She didn't look nearly as much like an idiot when she thought no one was paying any attention to her. It seemed like justice that perhaps this time Declan was the one getting played.
"I'm not saying you're wrong, Declan," Gansey said.
His ear throbbed where it had been boxed. He could feel Ronan's pulse crashing in his arm where he restrained him. His vow to consider his words more carefully came back to him, and so he framed the rest of the statement in his head before saying it out loud.
"But you are not Neil Lynch, and you won't ever be, and you get ahead a lot faster if you stopped trying."
Gansey released Ronan. Ronan didn't move, though, and neither did Declan. As if by saying their father's name, Gansey had cast a spell. They wore matching raw expressions, different wounds inflicted by the same weapon.
"I'm only trying to help," Declan said finally, but he sounded defeated.
There was a time, a few months ago, when Gansey would have believed him. Next to Gansey, Ronan's hands hung open at his sides. Sometimes, after Adam had been hit, there was something remote and absent in his eyes, like his body belonged to someone else. When Ronan was hit, it was the opposite. He became so urgently present that it was as if he'd been sleeping before. Ronan told his brother, "I'll never forgive you." The Volvo's window hissed closed, as if Ashley had just realized that this had become a conversation she wasn't meant to hear. Sucking on his bloody lip, Declan looked at the ground for a bare moment. Then he straightened and adjusted his tie.
"Wouldn't mean much from you anymore," he said, and tugged open the Volvo's door. As he slid into the driver's seat, Declan said, "I don't want to talk about it," to Ashley, and slammed the door shut.
The Volvo's tires squealed as they bit into the pavement, and then Gansey and Ronan were left standing next to each other in the strange, dim light of the parking lot. A block away, a dog barked balefully 3 times. Ronan touched his pinky finger to his eyebrow to check for blood, but there was none, just a raised, angry bump.
"Fix it," Gansey said.
He wasn't entirely sure that whatever Ronan had done or failed to do was easily corrected, but he was sure that it must be corrected. The only reason Ronan was allowed to stay at Monmouth Manufacturing was because his grades were acceptable. "Whatever it is, don't let him be right," Ronan said low just for Gansey.
"I want to quit.
One more year."
"I don't want to do this for another year."
He kicked a piece of gravel under the Camaro. Now his voice did rise, but only in ferocity, not in volume.
"Another year and then I get strangled with a necktie like Declan? I'm not a damn politician, Gansey. I'm not a banker."
Gansey wasn't either, but it didn't mean he wanted to leave school. The pain in Ronan's voice meant he couldn't have any in his when he said, "Just graduate and do whatever you want." The trust funds from their fathers had ensured that neither of them had to work for a living ever if they didn't choose to. They were extraneous parts in the machine that was society, a fact that sat differently on Ronan's shoulders than Gansey's. Ronan looked angry, but he was in the mood where he was going to look angry no matter what.
"I don't know what I want. I don't know what the hell I am."
He got into the Camaro.
"You promised me," Gansey said through the open car door. Ronan didn't look up.
"I know what I did, Gansey.
Don't forget."
When Ronan slammed the door, it echoed across the parking lot in the too loud way of sounds after dark. Gansey joined Adam at his safely distant vantage point. In comparison to Ronan, Adam looked clean, self-contained, utterly in control. From somewhere he had gotten a rubber ball printed with a SpongeBob logo, and he bounced it with a pensive expression.
"I convinced them not to call the cops," Adam said. He was good at making things quiet.
Gansey let out his breath. Tonight he didn't have it in him to talk to the police on Ronan's behalf.
"Tell me I'm doing the right thing with Ronan. Tell me this is how to find the old Ronan. Tell me I'm not ruining him by keeping him away from Declan."
But Adam had already told Gansey he thought Ronan needed to learn to clean up his own messes. It was only Gansey who seemed afraid that Ronan would learn to live in the dirt. So he merely asked, "Where's Noah?"
"He's coming. I think he was leaving a tip."
Adam dropped the ball and caught it again. He had an almost mechanical way of snapping his fingers around the ball as it bounced back toward him. One moment his hand was open and empty, and the next tight shut around it. Bounce. Snap. Gansey said, "So, Ashley."
"Yes," Adam replied, as if he'd been waiting for him to bring her up.
"Quite some eyes on her." It was an expression his dad used all the time, a family catchphrase for someone nosy. Adam asked, "Do you think she's really here for Declan?"
"Why else would she be here?"
"Glendower," Adam replied immediately. Gansey laughed, but Adam didn't.
"Really? Why else?"
Instead of answering, Adam twisted his hand and released the rubber ball. He'd chosen his trajectory carefully. The ball bounced off the greasy asphalt once, struck one of the Camaro's tires, and arced high in the air, disappearing in the black. He stepped forward in time for it to slap in his palm. Gansey made an approving noise. Adam said,
"I don't think you should talk to people about it anymore."
"It's not a secret."
"Maybe it should be."
Adam's uneasiness was contagious, but logically there was nothing to support suspicion. For 4 years, Gansey had been searching for Glendower, freely admitting this fact to all and any who showed interest, and he'd never seen the slightest evidence of anyone else sharing his precise quest. He had to admit, however, that the suggestion of that possibility gave him a peculiarly unpleasant feeling. He said, "It's all out there, Adam. Pretty much everything I've done is public record. It's too late for it to be a secret. It was too late years ago." "Come on, Gansey," Adam said with some heat. "Don't you feel it? Don't you feel?"
"Feel what?"
Gansey despised fighting with Adam, and somehow this felt like a fight. Unsuccessfully, Adam struggled to put his thoughts into words. Finally, he replied, "Observed." Across the parking lot, Noah had finally emerged from Nino's and he slouched toward them. In the Camaro, Ronan's silhouetted form lay back in the seat, head tilted as if he slept. Close by, Gansey could smell roses and grass mowed for the first time that year. And farther away, he smelled damp earth coming to life beneath last year's fallen leaves, and water